think Infinitum's vow of mission, it's the doing. It's the action that comes after the surrendering and understanding generosity. Mission is how we take action and move forward with it. It's how we bring the kingdom here on earth.
I think mission is the overflow of a heart that has truly encountered the work of Jesus on the cross. Because when you grasp that at the cross, Jesus dealt with all your sin and all the brokenness that comes from that sin, you begin to realize that you are called not only to be a recipient of grace and restoration, but a messenger and a deliverer of it.
And the picture I have is with the father with his arms open up wide and the child running to the father.
Our mission comes from Jesus' Great Commission in Matthew 28:18-20. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And surely I am with you always.
That vow is enacting or bringing God's kingdom into a world that is so hungry, and bringing a message of hope and life into a world that actually is dying. It's a vow that really has to begin in the very inner parts of our being. Actually, it was once Leslie Newbegin who said, "Mission begins with an explosion of joy," and that vow is actually rooted in what God has done and given us, and we bring that into the world.
Mission is vital for me because it stops my life being just about me. Instead, it joins me with God's broader, better, wider purposes for the whole of this world.
And because brokenness can take a thousand forms, mission has to take a thousand forms. But at the center of it all is the work of Jesus on the cross.
I believe missions, it's about bringing Jesus and his truth to wherever we are. I think it's not only about going into different nations, it's about being salt and light in our neighborhood, in our city, in our workplace. If we have a calling to be an artist or to be involved with politics, okay, how we can make that our mission field.
It is a willingness to share our faith with other people, verbally and in practical ways, so that everyone can know the love, saving power of God himself.
Hi Diamond, it's Gary. Just wondering, can we share some of your story? Is that okay?
Oh yeah, I'm more than happy to the story to go out to people, so yeah, no problems.
The Book of Esther, chapter 4, verse 14. For if you remain silent of its time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this.
While I was working in Pakistan back in the 90s, what I saw was that a lot of children were coming to hospital with infectious and diarrheal diseases. In those days, the infant mortality rate, which is a number of children dying in 1 year, under 1 year olds, per 1,000 live births. So that was around 90 plus per 1,000 live births, which meant that out of 10 children born, one would not be alive by his or her first birthday.
So I looked further into this and found out there are roughly 14,000 babies born each day in Pakistan. So that's 1,400 babies that would be born each day that wouldn't make it to their first birthday. 1,400.
And looking at the reasons why this was happening, a lot of babies were dying because of infectious diseases and diarrheal diseases. And what we identified was that the major factor was bottle feeding. and the babies who were breastfed were actually more healthy, and they had more resistance to fight infections, and they were not getting as much episodes of diarrhea as children who were being fed on bottle feed. The families did not have access to clean drinking water. And when they were mixing the formula in dirty water, that was causing diarrheal diseases. The other issue was that the formula was quite expensive, and people actually had to struggle to buy the formula. And what moms would do was that they would prepare a diluted formula. So instead of adding 1 to 1, that's taking like 4 ounces of water and adding 4 scoops of formula. They would make the formula diluted, so in 4 ounces of water they would just add 2 scoops of formula.
So the babies were getting less nutrition and were getting malnourished. And again, a malnourished child would be more prone to infection, and because of the dirty water they would get more diarrhea, and so they would enter a vicious cycle of malnutrition, infection, more malnutrition, more infection, and a cycle that sadly made it impossible for the baby to survive.
Seeing was that a lot of these babies was presenting in hospital at a terminally ill stage, and they required a lot of support, and but many of the babies would not make it, and that was the reason of high mortality rates. What we realized was that some of the formula companies were promoting their infant formulas in a very unethical way. The way they would do this is promoting their formula by advertisement and then directly contacting mothers and giving them free samples, and so promoting the formula. Others would use medical professionals, so they would approach pediatricians, and what they would do was provide gifts to pediatricians, and in return they would prescribe the formula, and to the extent that some of the pediatricians would even say to moms that their breast milk was not right for the baby and the formula was better. So this is what was happening, and I found it quite unethical.
Is at this point we cut across to Saeed, a man who started working for one of the formula companies in December 1994. It was a dream come true to work for a multinational company, and he was quickly indoctrinated into their practice. His job was to promote formula to health workers, and he had the tools and training to do so as effectively as possible. This included a fund for paying bribes to doctors, and ways to get approval for larger items like air conditioners from senior executives for what they designated AAA doctors, those who had a lot of influence on prescribing practices. One day in March 1997, Saeed was visiting one of the 200 doctors on his regular circuit. He frequently visited this doctor, but this was one of the few who didn't accept the company bribes. It was this visit which became a life-changing moment for himself and possibly hundreds of thousands of lives, because the doctor he was visiting that day was Diamond.
One day when he was visiting me, I was called in emergency to attend a very dehydrated sick baby who came with diarrhea. And he was brought in a very terminal stage, and despite all the intervention we did, the baby could not survive. This medical representative from this formula company who was sitting in my office just asked what happened, and I was so disturbed by everything that happened that I actually said it was people like him and the companies who were responsible for a lot of infant deaths, because the history was that in this particular baby, he was initially breastfed, but then changed to bottle feeding. And since being on bottle feed, he started having diarrhea and gradually lost weight and ultimately ended up in emergency.
It was this moment that shocked and shook Saeed. He had no idea the serious health implications that the promotion of baby powder was causing. As he walked out past the grieving family, back to his own, he realised the injustice of the company's practice. So he resigned from his position and set out producing a legal notice attaching nearly 80 pages of evidence informing the formula company to stop its unethical practices. But such a large battle would not be easily fought.
He actually wrote a notice to his company saying that they should stop the unethical marketing of infant formulas, and that actually flared up the company bosses, and there was a lot of lashback from the company, and what they did was initially they tried to threaten this young man, and then somehow they knew that I was also supporting it. So some members of the formula company, they actually visited me at my home, and they issued threats saying that if anything was taken any further, there will be difficult times for us.
For Saeed, this meant he had to leave his house, his family, flee to a different city, a different country, and eventually seek asylum in Canada.
Same was the issue with me, that I also had to kind of leave that city and go to another city to continue my practice, and ultimately things got worse, and I also decided to move out of Pakistan and come to live here in the UK. So yeah, it was a difficult time. When I look back and see at that point whatever I did and the steps I took, I think I was really not sure how hard it could be. But for me, looking at that, what we call a social injustice, it was hard for me to stay quiet and not do what I did. Because what I understand as a Christian, this is a very important to raise your voice whenever you see injustice happening. And I was very strongly of the idea that this was a social injustice where people were being forced into doing something which was not right for them, and they were being misled. And I think at that point, if I had stayed quiet, this would have been kind of it would have not brought all this out, and people would have continued to be suffering.
It was a step of incredible bravery and boldness to speak out against the injustice that was taking place. And from this bravery, word spread to various NGOs and organisations who helped to communicate and share some of the message of what was taking place. Stricter rules and regulations were put in place, and more thorough checks were organised. Now, 20 years on from that significant day, times have changed.
I won't say that the practice, the unethical practice, totally finished, but it did reduce to some extent. Currently, what I see is when I go back to Pakistan and visit places, I see that it still goes on, but definitely to a lesser extent. And the infant mortality rate, which was like around 90 plus, has now gone down to between 60 and 70. I mean, it's still very high, I would say, still very high. But there has been some reduction in infant mortality rate.
Now, to jump back to the estimates I shared earlier, of 14,000 babies being born each day in Pakistan, the change in infant mortality rate works out at 450 babies each day. 450 lives every day. Now, there are many factors in these changes, but the significance of what has been done through their bravery cannot be understated. That's almost 200,000 children a year, 4 million over the last 20 years. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this.
What I see is in my Christian life that I'm more of the strong idea that if I see injustice as a Christian, I have to raise my voice, and even though it comes up with a lot of difficulties, still the satisfaction is there that you have done what is right.
Just wow. I presume you haven't heard that story before, and if so, I wouldn't be surprised, because I just can't communicate enough the extreme difficulty that I've discovered that was faced as Saeed particularly was trying to share this story with the world. There was a German TV crew that came and filmed everything, and then on the day of release, the airing was cancelled and the showing was prohibited. There was a BBC documentary that was scheduled to be made, and mysteriously all the plans were cancelled. An Oscar-winning director produced an outstanding film called Tigers, all on the story, but again, like, good luck getting hold of it. I was so passionate to share this story on here because I just find that moment the salesman and the doctor shared together in that room at that time was so profound. Because I think so often we think of mission as having to go somewhere else, when so often it's about being where we are, in our jobs, in our homes, in our families, in our communities. I firmly believe that Diamond's actions help to end so much injustice and bring about the kingdom of God in that country and others. And I just hope and pray that I'm attentive and present enough to my life to do the same wherever and whenever God leads me. So on that note, we're going to rejoin Phil Wall and Daniel Strickland, who are going to continue to unpack further for us the vow of mission in our everyday. Over to them.
So the mission vow, and also we struggled with sort of the right name for this one too, yeah, didn't we? But we did know that the life of Jesus is characterized by a bias for the poor. I mean, yeah, his life was on purpose getting in the way, so he could intentionally posture his life to see the outcast, the folks who didn't belong, the ones who weren't welcome, whether they were, you know, economically poor, or they were ostracized or unwelcome in religious circles, or, you know, whatever those stereotypes were, that Jesus lived a life of inclusion. And so the hand posture for that one we use is our hands outstretched. And I really love, I think Ian made that prayer up around the father, the prodigal father going out looking for the son, saying, "You're welcome home." You know, I love that idea of going to the excluded, you know, the beautiful scripture where God says God puts the lonely in family, and recognizing as disciples, we literally are the people who welcome the prodigals home, the excluded, the lost, whether they deserve it or not, is that open embrace to say, "We see you, we're looking for you, we're running to you, you know, we're going in your direction, we're seeking you, and please come home." You know, there's something so profound about a life that's postured that way.
Yeah. I think we want to be really explicit also and say to people, hey, a mission isn't for professionals, mission isn't for religious types or vicars or, you know, whatever. We are all on mission. You know, I mean, the Blues Brothers is a great movie. And it was, but he was right. Yeah, we are on a mission from God, absolutely. And of course, the Salvation Army, we had the same mission. It's the band, you know. We got to get the band. But I think that's true. I think it's a statement of truth. We are on a mission, absolutely. And I think one of the great challenges for many folks, particularly those that don't work for the church, is to see their life through the lens of mission. So I go to work every day as a teacher or as a banker or as a lawyer, or I'm a house parent, or I'm someone who works in the community, or whatever. In what way is my life missional? And we wanted to have this in there to help people to explore what that might mean for them. A, we're followers of Jesus. So as you say, we have an orientation towards the poor. That might mean you're a giver. That might mean you're an advocate. That might mean you write letters. That might mean you work in different environments. But for every of us, somehow, in some way, our lives are orientated towards the dispossessed in some way. Mm-hmm. But also seeing our lives mm-hmm. as missionary lives. Right. And of course, many of us have grown up in churches where we say, well, no, the missionaries are the people that are on the, you know, in many churches, you've got that map of the world, and then there's a bit of red wool that goes from a pin down to a photograph of you know, a lovely family. And then there's, you know, people have gone here, or there are people have gone through that college or been through that training or have gone to that place. Whereas, as we understand the New Testament, anybody who says, I follow Jesus, is on mission. The only question is, what does that look like? And I think we want to provide a really creative and we hopefully an empowering space for people to explore what that might mean for them to go to work or do what they do with the bulk of their time every day with a missionary focus, that I am on a mission. And I think part of our confusion around this is this dualism thing between ministry and work and vocation at work. So I think I have a job. I run a business. I run a very successful business. You know, it's great. That's my job. I hope I do my job well. I hope my clients are pleased with the work that I live in. That's my job. That pays my bills. That, you know, puts me in a community. My vocation actually is a little bit different to that. And I think lots of people sometimes get confused thinking that the vocation and that job need to be the same thing. It doesn't need to be the same thing at all. I think it's really interesting when we think about the Apostle Paul. And, you know, arguably, you know, the greatest, you know, apostolic evangelist in the history of the church. And you know, lots of the, you know, when you ask the people in theological classrooms, I did a little while ago, I said, you know, what were the names of the group that the Apostle Paul first shared the gospel with? And they came in all these different names of geographies. And no, it's none of those. They were called clients. They were clients of his. They bought tents from him because that was his job. His vocation, it was preaching the gospel, but his job was to sell tents. That was his job. And of course, they wove together beautifully. And I think we want to try and find a place where, you know, it's easier for those that have gone on a vocational track in a denominational stream or whatever. That's great. We want you to think about, what does it mean to be missional? Not what it mean to be a vicar, or what does it mean to be truly missional in your life? And get out of bed every day with that kind of intent. And for those that aren't in that space, i.e. the bulk of Christians around the world, you know, the vast majority of believers that have ever lived haven't been ministers. We're the people on the front line. We're the people who are amongst people every single day who don't know Jesus. And in a country like mine, the UK, where maybe 5-6% of the country are actually followers of Jesus, for the vast majority of us, amongst our friends, we are probably the only Christian they know. Right. I had a phone call a few years ago from a friend of mine, and I didn't realize he was ringing me. I didn't realize it because he left a message on my phone, and he was really quite tearful on the phone. It took me a little while to work out who he was, and he's a guy I care for a great deal, and very tragic, his wife at the time had been rushed to hospital with a brain tumor. And so he's trying to explain what happened and everything else. I'm just listening to the message, and at the end of the message he said this to me. He said, Phil, I know you're on holiday and I'm sorry to trouble you, but I had to ring you because you're the only person I know who prays. So please, would you pray for my wife?
Wow.
And that's true for the vast majority of Christians,
right,
on the face of planet Earth, that for particularly in the Western world. We are quite possibly the only Christian that many of our friends know. So we need to be on a mission.
Well, and you know, it's interesting too, because we've convinced ourselves for some reason, and it's a bit of a lie, because if you live missionally, so if you're looking for opportunities to live like Jesus and to present Jesus, I mean, the word Christian itself means little Christ. So we are meant to be like Jesus to the people around us. But we've kind of convinced ourselves that people are against us. So it puts us in a defensive posture when actually people, for the most part, people are not against us at all. They're looking for places where someone will pray for them, like an opportunity. So we recently, you know, went to the LA Convention Center. We set up an anti-human trafficking booth at a sex show there. And the people that were part of that, putting that on, it was all of their first time. And they just were like terrified in many ways, like, like, what will we do? And how will we come across and how will this work out? And I assured them it's all going to be great because I've done a whole bunch of them all around the world. And so I trained them and then said, bye. I had to go to Hong Kong. I was like, have a good weekend. And I came back and said, you know, how did it go? And they just like, I mean, they were like over them. They just were like, we could not believe, you know, there was, we had this prayer booth at the at the booth that we had. We have this prayer station for free words from God, you know, is how we sort of frame it. And they said there was just a lineup like halfway down the show of people waiting in line to get a word from God. And I said, is there anything in the booth we should have had that we didn't have? And they said, yeah, unanimously, they all said, yeah, we needed tissues, way more tissues. And they just recounted person after person after person they prayed with who just could not believe that God loved them, that he had a plan for them, that there was good news for them, that we didn't judge them, you know, that they, I mean, they carry so much shame. And so this team really, what they did in debrief was really repented for their own sense of like, these people won't be interested. Like this is going to be dangerous. Like they're going to be closed. And we have these, same with our neighbors, same with like it's story after story after story of people who we've convinced ourselves don't want us or don't want Jesus or don't. And it took me so many years to figure out. I remember I coached a high school basketball team and in a rural community. So we used to go on the road a lot in a bus. And I would do my preach prep with them basically and say, okay, guys, what do you think of this? And I tell them the story and stuff. And I was telling the Easter story and one of the students said to me, I don't understand like why Jesus had to die. Like it makes no sense to me. And so we had this amazing conversation about why Jesus had to die and the atonement. And it struck me that when she asked me those questions and I got back and I remember thinking, I've judged this entire generation as rejecting the gospel. And I didn't realize that actually they just have never heard the gospel. And I was so convicted because they've only had this like MTV version. And I realized that we have not postured ourselves to communicate the truth and or to be missional or to get in the way or to represent Jesus in the world. And as a result, people don't know. So they're literally judging the church for what they think, but they don't, because Christians aren't being missional. They're not seeing Christ. And so they're judging them on all the wrong. They don't understand. So I feel like it's such an important part of what it means to be a disciple. What it means to follow Jesus is to represent him to people around us and to be intentional about getting in the way and seeing the people that are invisible in society.
I think what's really exciting also is when you start to step into that place.
Yeah.
When you're saying, okay, Lord, I want to be missional.
Yes.
I want to put myself in a place whereby, for example, I may get a chance to either pray with someone or tell someone I'm praying for or even share my story, how those opportunities come about.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone through a really interesting theological shift as a sharer of the Jesus story over the last few years. I think what I used to believe was my job as a missionary was to go and find lots of creative ways to start people thinking about God. Mm-hmm. You know. And then I read a quote from one of the church founding fathers who had many beliefs I would fundamentally disagree with, particularly around women. He said this. He said, we worship a God who is constantly lapping at the shores of people's lives. Mm. And I've reflected on that a great deal. And I think my theology shifted quite dramatically from a place of saying, I need to go out there into that world and try and start as many conversations and get into it with all these people so they might start to consider God.
Mm-hmm.
To the place I find myself now, completely different, saying, God, for you to be the God of the Bible, every microsecond of every single day, there cannot be 1 second of any human being's existence where you are not seeking to win them and woo them to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is, you are not the God of the Bible.
Right.
And believing that,
mm-hmm.
my question now as I seek to live authentically for Jesus and missional life is not, hey, how do I get into conversation? My first mm-hmm. question is, what are you doing, God?
Right.
How are you seeking to win and woo this person to yourself? Because I know you are.
Yes.
I just got to figure out what it is. And you do that by asking questions.
Yes.
And that is just such a much more confident place. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're getting on board with a winning team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're building what's already been built.
Mm-hmm.
And you are just coming into their story with your story at a particular moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so freeing
mm-hmm.
and so confidence building to come at it from that direction. So
mm-hmm.
I would say I think I'd have probably said, you know, well, this is the really committed missional mindset mm-hmm. I used to have. I need to be out there doing all this thing. I think this new fresh mindset or insight or whatever you want to describe it is much more missional.
Because
actually what I'm doing is I'm finding out what has God already done
mm-hmm.
and how do I get on board with that?
Yeah.
And that's really, really exciting.
Which is a lot more about partnership with kingdom than agenda-driven sort of push your truth on people. Remember,
and
Michael
people sense that, don't they? They sense that. Yeah, they know, like, you know, big loudmouth like me. You know, they know. You got an agenda. You say, well, actually, my agenda is first to listen. Let me understand.
Yeah.
Tell me your story. Where you at?
Yeah. Sorry, I had someone one time come running up to me, like, you know, knowing who I was, and just sort of said, "I don't believe in God," and I just said to them, "I'll be sure to let him know." You know. It was just. They were like, "Oh, like I was just like, I'll let him know. Like, what do you want? Oh, great." Knock yourself out. Yeah.
Fantastic.
And Michael Frost once said, I heard him say recently that, you know, the question we really should all be asking is, are we living a questionable life? In other words, when people look at our lives, are they like, what? You know, what is that? Like, what is that? And I was like, that's such a great way to frame it. I think that's, if I could describe missional living, it's a questionable life. It's like, why? You're friends with whom? You know, and I delight in this idea of inviting, you know, normal people over for dinner and having a homeless friend who's hanging out there at the same time. And, you know, just instantly their lives have expanded. You know, they've never even thought of, you know, they've seen them from a distance. And now it's like, wow, they're friends with somebody. Yeah. But they never would be friends. See, across social spectrums and all kinds of things. Is your life questionable? Is it like, are people going, huh, what is that about? And I feel like that's a good, rather than this agenda of like, I have to be, you know, on some sort of mission from God, intentional, agenda driven. It's this beautiful posture of God's at work in the world and we're partnering with him. I mean, Jesus lived the most questionable life of all. Everybody was like, what are you doing? Everybody, even the disciples are like, what's going on? So I feel like that beautiful idea of living a questionable life, you know.
Well, he posed more questions than he preached, didn't he? And I think maybe Frost, he's quoting that. I can't remember the quote, but he said, you know, we must live our lives in such a way that they make no sense at all unless God exists.
Right.
And maybe that's where he got quoted. But I think that's the essence of mission is living a life that makes no sense to anybody at all unless God exists.
Yes.
Such as the provocation of how we live.
That's great. That's beautiful. That's a vow worth living. Mission. Let's do it.